Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Matthew S. Henry, author of Hydronarratives, Water, Environmental Justice, and a Just Transition, published last year by University of Nebraska Press. Dr. Henry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So this book actually emerges from my dissertation project, which I completed at Arizona State University back in 2018. And it was inspired a bit. I guess one of the sort of first inspirations for this book was when I was in a graduate class and I read Stephanie LeMenager's of Living Oil. And it was a book that really resonated with me. And my dissertation advisor, Joni Adamson, said, hey, you should do a dissertation like this on water. And of course, we're in Arizona. I don't know, 2014 or 2015, a really particularly intense period of the current ongoing drought in the lower Colorado River Basin. And I'd been sort of trending towards doing something on water. And so that's sort of how this project was born. Initially, I thought I would write a dissertation on water that sort of included some of the sort of authors that I grew up with. I'm originally from Western Montana, and I grew up fly fishing, whitewater rafting, spending a lot of time around streams and water. And of course, I grew up reading things like A River Runs Through It and Edward Abbey, sort of typical white, sort of outdoor recreation oriented male authors, right? And so I quickly realized that they'd been written about too much, and that the sort of crux of the issue, specifically in Arizona around drought, was indigenous water rights, climate and environmental justice issues. And so I really sought to orient this project around sort of the problematic of environmental justice and water justice. As a dissertation, this project was really sort of more of a typical sort of eco-critical project that I think maybe departed a little bit from usual eco-criticism, in that it sort of analyzed a pretty broad archive of texts. I sort of took the word texts broadly. So looking at things like, the book large looks at, or the dissertation, I should say, looked at, museum exhibits, public art exhibits, literary fiction, poetry, photography, all sorts of things like that. But it still, theoretically was more grounded in sort of more traditional eco-critical literary theory. As I sort of sought to develop this book into a book project, it really evolved into something a little bit different than that. And most of the book, actually all of the book, was written, during my time, as a scholar in residence, at the University of Wyoming. And what's important about that is when I was appointed here, at the University of Wyoming, my appointment was in three separate departments. I was in our, Environment and Natural Resources program, our Department of English, and then also our School of Energy Resources. And in the School of Energy Resources, I was doing a lot of work on just energy transitions in the rural West, partially because I have some energy humanities background, and that sort of was how I got the job here, right? So in that time, I started really working within the framework of Just Transitions, Just Transition Frameworks. And I realized that was a really useful way of thinking about and thinking through water justice issues was thinking about transition. We often talk about just transition in terms of energy and decarbonization, right? But looking around specifically in the Western U.S., but also elsewhere, I think the word transition is a really useful term for thinking about sort of new realities around water and water systems in the United States, specifically with regard to how frontline and fence line communities are experiencing things like drought, sea level rise, municipal water contamination, those sorts of things. So this is where the sort of just transition framework came into the book. And I didn't rewrite it from scratch, but I'd say it's about 70% of the book is actually new or different material from the dissertation. But that said, the first chapter of the book really emerges from my work in Arizona. So it's focused on sort of decolonizing drought discourse in the Western United States. So really starting with drought and moving outward to sort of thinking about water crises in the United States broadly. And, you know, if you read the blurb on the back of my book, one of the major concerns I'm thinking about in this book is the extent to which sort of dominant cultural and environmental narratives have sort of historically rendered certain communities disposable or expendable in pursuit of economic growth. And that's true with water, specifically around, you know, if my sort of origin first chapter looks at the extent to which dams and reservoirs and irrigation systems have, traditionally sort of remade the Western U.S. into what it is today at the expense specifically of indigenous peoples. And so really the book is sort of thinking about how narratives of disposability or expendability of peoples have led to these sort of water crises as we think of them today. And so therefore, sort of my main goal or my main contention is, in this book, is thinking about how counter narratives or stories from affected communities can help these communities sort of imagine or work towards just sustainable futures within a just transition framework. And I use the term just transition not as it's often used in, like, you know, sort of think tank or policy documents, but I'm looking at the way in which climate justice organizations use just transition as a sort of shift from an extractive economy to a regenerative economy that's predicated on social justice, economic equity, and sustainability. So that's the sort of origin story of the book, and I'm happy to, you know, go into a lot more depth.
Yeah, you kind of partway answered several of the questions that I have. So that's a good jumping off point to ask you to go into a little more detail there. So let's start with this term hydro narratives, which is, it's obviously something to do with narratives about water. But can you explain a little bit about, you know, how exactly you're defining hydro narratives and why they matter?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. So I'm really thinking about cultural representations that sort of story our human relationships with water and water systems. And the reason I chose narrative is because I'm really analyzing cultural representations that help produce or counter sort of existing cultural narratives. So a lot of what the book analyzes is cultural narratives, specifically, say, in the Western United States around the region being arid and unproductive and therefore in need of being reclaimed, or a region that is depopulated, a sort of Edenic place, you know, the sort of typical narratives of indigenous erasure. So I'm really thinking about the interface between cultural forms, cultural representations, and the way they contribute to or counter sort of broader cultural narratives. And one way we can distinguish this from, say, Hannah Bost's wonderful book, Hydro Fictions, is that, you know, she's looking at Israeli and Palestinian literary fiction primarily in that book. And I didn't want to narrow my focus on simply literary fiction. And so I chose narrative more broadly. And sort of the contention is that narrative and storytelling can be really important in terms of both apprehending historical injustices, but also thinking about and working towards new or better better futures, right? So that's my sort of broad definition of hydro narratives. I know it's kind of a mouthful, but I think that word narrative does a little bit more work there than, say, hydro fictions, or I've seen hydro stories tossed around, and just different work, not necessarily better work, but just a different objective aim in that designation.
Yeah, and I appreciate the breadth of that narratives concept that you're bringing in, not just literary fiction, but also art and museum exhibits and, you know, all the other ways that we tell narratives.
True. So, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. Okay, so you're coming at the issue of environmental justice from this environmental humanities kind of point of view. So how does that differ from and add to the more conventional or familiar social science kind of approaches to environmental justice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I took a lot of inspiration from the work of Joni Adamson, the work of Julie C., other sort of similar scholars that don't really fit in a particular discipline, but really work across disciplines to think about environmental justice as not just the purview of the social sciences or the hard sciences of analyzing demographic data and so forth, but really thinking about how cultural and culture and storytelling and can really, you know, sort of have always been part of the environmental justice movement, have always enriched the environmental justice movement. And so their work was a huge inspiration to me in that they've always kind of straddled this line, you know, between scholarship and community advocacy and activism. And likewise, I really think the humanities, specifically analyzing cultural forms, can offer a different perspective on what, you know, sort of what environmental justice is beyond the sort of broad definition of the right of all people to enjoy the benefits bestowed by a healthy environment. It helps us understand sort of the origins of different ways of valuing the environment, different ways of interacting with the environment, different ways of knowing that aren't always as detectable, say, in the social sciences, right? So I think that sort of different modes of storytelling help us get at that in ways that other disciplines don't. And so, you know, tracing all the way back, for example, to the Environmental Justice Reader, I think that was published in something like 2000, this sort of cultural current that was prevalent in that book. There was a whole section devoted, for example, to poetics and literary criticism, and that sort of work that sort of carried on in a lot of the work of a lot of scholars I admire, and the sort of role of storytelling in sort of apprehending injustice, understanding the sort of roots of injustice, and then imagining and therefore then working towards alternative futures, I think is a really important way to conceive of justice beyond just the sort of policy making social sciences focus.
Okay. And then you mentioned in one of your earlier answers the idea of the just transition, and you actually brought up the thing that I wanted to kind of jump off from, which is that that's one of those terms that has hit that level of popularity that it has now branched off that, you know, different people are using that term in very different ways sometimes. So can you talk about, for the purposes of your book, how are you conceptualizing the idea of a just transition?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And, you know, you're absolutely right in that, you know, the just transition framework has sort of reached a sort of point of saturation in which it's sort of at times being used in ways that stray far from its origins, or being used in ways that don't really suggest, you know, gesture towards justice specifically. And I see this in, you know, articles I'm asked to peer review, or, you know, working, you know, with nonprofits and government officials and such. It's just being tossed around in every which way. So one thing, you know, I take pains to do, especially the introduction to my book, is sort of trace the origins of just transition as a framework to, you know, post 1970s, environmental legislation in the United States. You know, and it's funny, this morning I'm reading Silent Spring to teach in my grad class tonight, but I'm really thinking about this sort of what came in the aftermath of all of these new environmental regulations and regulatory agencies in the 1970s. And one of those was the sort of regulation of pollutive industries and the sort of emergence of Superfund efforts to, you know, to clean up contaminated work sites and contaminated environments. And what emerged from that was this concern amongst amongst workers in pollutive industries about, you know, not just, you know, not just what would happen to in terms of cleanup of the environment, but what would happen to the displaced workers in industries that were being regulated. And Tony Mizaki is one of those. He was a leader in the Oil Chemical and Atomic Workers Union or Association, and was really advocating for social safety net measures for workers who are being displaced from pollutive industries or industries that were being increasingly regulated. And he initially called this a super fund for workers, which doesn't have really a pleasant ring to it. But in conjunction with Barry Commoner, they came up with this idea of just transition for workers. And what that meant was thinking about things like workforce development and funds for retraining, funds for sort of helping communities sort of move past being dependent on specific pollutive industries and sort of, you know, thrive without those industries and think about job creation and community health in a sort of really holistic sense. And it was inspired by the GI Bill, believe it or not. So the idea of, you know, World War II veterans coming back and needing sort of, you know, government support or public support to reintegrate into civilian life. And so that's sort of the origins of Just Transition. And I really like those origins because it thinks about Just Transition really holistically. And you know, it's evolved since then, been adopted by environmental justice organizations like the Just Transition Alliance and others that were opposing NAFTA in the 1990s, you know, and the sort of emergence of sort of joint labor and environmental concerns, you know, with the advent of neoliberal trade policies, and, you know, has since been adopted in the sort of environmental justice and climate justice movement to really mean a sort of shift from one type of economy to another, one that exploits workers, does not concern itself with the environment or environmental protections, to one that is really more predicated on economic and social equity, and sustainability and resilience. And often climate justice organizations incorporate, you know, more other types of liberation movement platform items like, you know, for example, return of indigenous lands or reparations, climate reparations, or sort of more decolonial theory type of demands, right? And so that's where I'm really drawing on Just Transition from. And in the book, I use the Just Transition Alliance's sort of really robust framework for Just Transition as my sort of theoretical lens, right? So I really try to differentiate the sort of Just Transition we often hear about when it comes to energy, which is, you know, I'm in Wyoming and we're facing an energy transition here that's pretty substantial. And there's talk about Just Transition here, which is, you know, workforce development and, you know, affordable housing and some things that would allow certain coal dependent communities to weather the storm. And I think that's all really important, but Just Transition looks different in different places. And it's really about sort of responding to environmental change, economic change, and social change in ways that don't leave communities behind, encourage sort of community participation. There's a sort of participatory justice element to Just Transition, and sort of sovereignty in ways to determine the path forward for communities. So that's where I'm really trying to think about Just Transition and, quite frankly, rescue it from the ways in which it's being misappropriated all over the place at this point. So Yeah.
And I think you're right that we mostly hear the term Just Transition in the energy context. You know, I'm here in Pittsburgh, so we have the same kind of, you know, questions about the future of fossil fuels as we try to move to different sorts of energy sources, and some of the same you know, issues that sparked the Just Transition conversation. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about, you know, how this idea of the Just Transition looks a little bit different in the context of water as opposed to energy, where probably most people have encountered the idea before.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one thing, you know, I see more and more is talking about water in the Western United States as, you know, we're facing a water transition, and that's something that markets can't do as much about as, say, for example, you know, just transition in the fossil fuel industry is often, or transition in the fossil fuel industry is often sort of delayed or staved off by various sort of regulatory measures or subsidization of different industries. But in the West, you know, the Colorado River is drying up. There's not a lot we can do other than tweak allocations of water, try to come to some consensus amongst states about who gets how much water. And so transition in that sense in the Colorado River Basin is that it's pretty much inevitable. But ensuring that this sort of new reality around water is just and takes into account historical inequities, historical violences, specifically around settler colonialism, but also, you know, racial inequality as well. That's not guaranteed. That's not necessarily at the forefront of, for example, discussions between various state entities. And so one thing I think about a lot in the book is how more people can have a voice into determining what the water future looks like in their specific region. Now, it's obviously very different in central Arizona, what a just water transition looks like, a sort of way in which communities can adapt and be supported to adapt in ways that are just and take into consideration everyone. It looks a lot different in places like, for example, Flint, Michigan or Appalachia. In Appalachia, for example, you know, really been thinking about the coal transition and the fossil fuel transition there in comparison with Wyoming. And that transition looks different even than here in Wyoming, in that they've been going through the transition a little bit longer than we have here. There's been more time to plan for it, more time to think about diversifying the economy, and, you know, sort of more voices have been able to be heard. Whereas in Wyoming, that's quite different. And we also don't have a lot of opportunities to, for example, think about sort of prepare for the future. So just transition, I think, is really, it depends on, for example, historical injustices that have taken place in different places, and what the responses to those might look like. In my Flint chapter, I really think about, the extent to which the Flint water crisis was a product of racial capitalism. And I use Laura Pulido's work, and what she argues is that, more or less like the environmental justice movement in the United States has failed in a lot of ways because it's, you know, been primarily preoccupied with litigation and operating in courtrooms and sort of seeking court victories that are, you know, mainly limited to the sort of issue at hand, and argues that we need to think outside of the sort of traditional frameworks for seeking justice or relief in the courts. And so one way I think about what a just water transition would look like in Flint is the sort of reclamation of community identity, community sovereignty, specifically through art. And that might be street art, that might be performance art, but really just thinking outside of the box in terms of the ways in which we might think about what justice looks like in different places. So that's something that, you know, in like a lot of energy focused just transition literature is starting to come through, is that no two transitions are the same. Problems are different depending on a range of sort of cultural and political and economic factors in different locations, and that a sort of top down approach to sort of try to fit everybody, or, you know, every sort of situation within a sort of broad universalized just transition framework simply isn't going to work. So it's good to see that consensus on the sort of energy focused just transition side. I think it's the same thing. It's the same thing for water.
Okay. So, and you kind of touched on the four main case studies that make up the core of the book. So you've got Lower Colorado River, you've got Flint, Michigan, you've got Appalachia, and then you've got sea level rise. And I was thinking that we could do kind of a deep dive into one of them to sort of illustrate your approach to these kinds of questions, and then, you know, kind of leave the other ones as something for readers if they, you know, find your approach interesting and exciting, then they have a reason to go check out check out the book. And so the one that I wanted to do the deep dive on was that Lower Colorado River one, because I actually, back in the late aughts, I lived in Arizona, so I saw some of this up close, and I'd actually just gone back to visit for a week this winter, just before I got your book, and then I opened it, and there's this chapter on Arizona and the Central Arizona Project Canal and stuff, all this stuff that I had been noticing when I was, and reminded of when I was back down there. So just to start us off on that case study, what are some of the conventional narratives that get told about water in the Southwest? And then where do you find these counter narratives or different narratives to challenge that?
Yes, happy to go into that. So that, you know, I really start out in that chapter with thinking through the sort of original ways in which the West was viewed as a sort of space to carve up into neatly gridded parcels and irrigate and reclaim and sort of reinvigorate in the sort of image of the Garden of Eden, for example. And so, you know, I start with a sort of typical critique of, you know, John Wesley Powell's expedition west, in which he argued against, sort of irresponsible development of the West. But nevertheless, the sort of movement out west, or the progression west from east to west, in the late 1800s by Anglo-Americans, sort of ignored his advice and really sought to sort of transform land in ways they saw fit without, for example, building settlements alongside rivers or sources of water. And so he really argued for the sort of wise settlement of the West. And he's often hailed, you know, in some circles, as someone who sort of foresaw the drought in the Western United States. And however, what I try to do is problematize even Powell's thinking. You know, he was very much steeped in the sort of white Anglo settler colonial project. He was disdainful or dismissive of indigenous water use practices, and was really very much a sort of instrument of white settler progress and displacement of indigenous peoples going west, specifically in an ideological level. So I kind of work forward from John Wesley Powell and think about, you know, what was the narrative about the West and how did it evolve over time? You know, and initially, you know, viewed as a sort of terra nullius to settle, and water as a sort of instrument to develop the Western U.S. But also, even critiques of that model are often, you know, often exclude indigenous experiences or perspectives. So I kind of take Mark Reisner's book Cadillac Desert a little bit to task in the book, because, that's a sort of viewed as a sort of Bible for understanding water in the West. And it often pops up even in literary fiction as this sort of indispensable source for understanding water in the West. But Reisner too himself really doesn't really think about indigenous perspective or experiences, really just applies a sort of white settler environmentalist lens to the Western U.S. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful and an indispensable book, but it's also an incomplete book. And so I started thinking about the ways in which a lot of the ways we talk about drought and water in the West, like in dominant discourse, really ignores indigenous perspectives about what drought means and how, for example, water theft and displacement onto reservations really sort of produced conditions of drought and deprivation of water 100 years before now, say, these sort of settler cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas are experiencing some of the same things. So there's this kind of new narrative now about the newness of this drought, and it's and sort of an obsession with what the collapse of settler society might look like. And, you know, for example, coverage of the drought, you often see photographs of things like Lake Mead or Lake Powell sort of drying up, these sort of scenes of like abandoned marinas and stuff like that, which really sort of erases the ways in which, for example, the Gila River Indian community in the early 1900s was more or less, reduced to finding new ways of subsisting, because upstream white settlers started damming and diverting the Gila River for their own fields, right? And so there's this sort of earlier experience of drought, of deprivation of water that's sort of being lost in the mix. And so trying to really push back against both the sort of original sort of settler narratives in the late 1800s, early 1900s around reclaiming the Western U.S. to even the ways in which sort of ostensibly in pro-environmental narratives also exclude those perspectives as well. And so that's really what the sort of counter narratives are to that is that, you know, I use Kyle White's notion of collective continuous or continuance or this idea of social resilience in the face of this sort of efforts to erase indigenous presence and agency. And so really try to highlight the ways in which, you know, sort of indigenous communities, the Tohono O'odham, the sort of Gila River Indian community, the Colorado River Indian tribes, are really sort of asserting that presence through various artistic representations and also are continuing to play a sort of more important and broader role in discussions and planning for a future in which there's going to be a lot less water in the Western U.S. So try to sort of look at the way those sort of counter narratives sync up with the extent to which indigenous communities are aiming to and increasingly having a voice in sort of hydropolitical discourse in the Western United States.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested that you bring up one of the, I think, few ways that a lot of the dominant discourses about water in that part of the country do acknowledge the indigenous history is this like cautionary parable of the collapse of the Hohokam civilization and the way that gets used as kind of like, oh, they, you know, screwed it up and collapsed and now we might do the same thing. And you kind of point out, no, that's not actually really what happened at all.
Right.
Those people, like, their descendants are still there. You know, they went through some things and they changed, but they, you know, had that collective continuance, and, you know, the O'odham people are still there through both, you know, the stuff that happened, you know, pre-colonially and all the stuff they've had to deal with during the colonial era. And they're producing many of these narratives that you're looking at in that chapter.
Yeah, it's really interesting too, you know, having been down there working on this chapter as sort of, it's probably like the biggest holdover from my dissertation into the book. And one of the things I, you know, found really interesting was the ways in which, you know, Phoenix, Arizona is sort of superimposed on the Hohokam's, you know, sort of previous land usage markers, right? So like a lot of the canals from the Central Arizona Project, which, you know, brings water to the city, were previously Hohokam canals. And you know, Hohokam used water from the Salt River that flows through the Phoenix Valley, right? And, you know, there's this, you know, what I found really interesting was in Tempe, Arizona, where Arizona State University is, there's this old mill, it's not used anymore, that used water from the Salt River, and was really sort of a product of this sort of effort to reclaim, quote unquote, the Western United States from its sort of state of sort of misuse, right? And misuse with it in the capitalist sense. And one of the art pieces I look at is this this sort of mural set up by Odum artists that sort of that was put right in the shadow of that mill, and it sort of reasserts indigenous presence in the valley that is not always easy to see when you're driving through Phoenix or Tempe and you're seeing, you know, historical preservation of old, you know, of old agricultural settlements or buildings, or, you know, that sort of thing. And so this sort of like, it was to me sort of a really importantly strategic place to put this mural in the sort of shadow of this, old mill that, right, that used and siphoned, it sort of, you know, the mill was, you know, processing, you know, crops that were grown using water that was stolen from indigenous peoples, right? And so it's sort of this counter narrative that's very visceral. You can walk past it on the street down right downtown Tempe on Mill Avenue and look at it, and it's sort of calling attention to this deeper history of the area. So yeah, so there's a lot of ways that you can sort of, there's a lot of markers or indicators within the city. You just have to know kind of where to look for them. And I was specifically looking, you know, at different artistic representations, right? So.
Yeah. And as a geographer, I'm always excited to see how, you know, the where of things makes a difference. Like the art installation you were talking about, you know, what that means draws a lot on where it's located. You know, it wouldn't be the same if they put up those same paintings somewhere else, that the location contributes to the story that it's telling. And then I also wanted to talk a bit about, you know, another one of these like narratives that's not a conventional, like, you know, fictional text narrative that you talk about in that chapter, which is the Pueblo Grande Museum in Phoenix, which I actually visited this past December. So it was fun reading your take on it after I had just been there. And a lot of things that you mentioned, you know, I noticed as well when I was there. I didn't do quite the depth of analysis that you did, but I noticed some of the things there about how they are telling the story differently than even a lot of the other museums and things that I went to in Arizona. So can you talk a bit about the Pueblo Grande Museum and how they're both kind of deliberately and also inadvertently telling this counter narrative about water?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, first glance, the Pueblo Grande Museum, you know, is a, you know, sort of typically curated sort of archaeological curiosity within the city of Phoenix. And it's situated between these highways, you know, these major highways that flow through the city that sort of take you to downtown Phoenix or the suburbs, and sort of, you know, calls attention to the extent to which Phoenix is such a sprawling place that's utterly dependent on this sort of unsustainable water use, you know, approach to water use, right? And, you know, you go in and it's sort of got the history of the Hohokam sort of curated inside, you know, with sort of replicas of, you know, and murals and sort of dioramas of the sort of history of the Hohokam in Phoenix. And then, of course, you go outside and, you know, Pueblo Grande, you know, translates to big house, and it was sort of this viewed as a sort of strategically important structural site with a you know, that sort of controlled some of the extent to which water flowed from some of the larger main canals from the Salt River into the different you know, the smaller canals going out into the Hohokam's fields, right? And so it's, you know, it's really interesting as you walk through and you think about it, you know, and sort of its positioning in the city. It's sort of, you know, beneath the shadow of these huge buildings and these highways and these developments and so forth. And but as you look closer, you know, the thing I noticed first when I went is that it doesn't, you know, narrate a history of Hohokam disappearance the way you might find in a lot of histories of the Hohokam, but calls on and incorporates sort of oral histories from their descendants in the region, the Odum specifically, right? And so so that was notable in that it doesn't narrate this sort of myth of disappearance. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, when you go outside to the outdoor part of the site, what you find is a replica of a Hohokam garden. And they've got plants growing in it, some traditional crops, and they've, got these rows of crops. And when I went the first time, they had recently been watered. The soil was wet. And so you're looking at this and they sort of call you to imagine what it might have looked like a thousand years ago. But then sticking right out of the soil to the left of the garden is this copper pipe in a sort of like, it looks kind of like a staple into the ground, right? And the valve lever was turned to the on position. And it's sort of this like really rude reminder that like in order to replicate this history, we must rely on this other water system that is hidden beneath the ground, that's difficult to represent, the sort of labyrinthine sort of network of canals and municipal water infrastructure that's bringing water from the Salt River and the Colorado River and, potentially groundwater and so forth. And so it's this sort of dissonance, right, in going there. And that I think it's unintentional, but it seems that the museum is really trying to sort of juxtapose or at least achieve juxtaposition between these two different ways of harnessing water and using water in the region in ways that sort of make it impossible to ignore that which existed prior to this sort of palimpsest of settler infrastructure on the city. And I don't think they mean it as sort of a political commentary, although I do appreciate, and I think it's important that it doesn't, that overall the experience there doesn't sort of narrate this myth of, the sort of vanishing Indian, right, that was sort of central to the settler colonial project. But the other thing that I found really interesting when I visited the Pueblo Grande Museum is that they have this sort of gallery of rotating art exhibits inside. And so they can change every month. And when I went there, there was this exhibit that was, I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was put on by a local photographer by the name of Wayne Norton. And it was essentially sort of a eulogy to the West, the sort of West sort of falling into decline due to drought. And so it was all these pictures, black and white pictures of, beached boats at marinas at Lake Powell and, abandoned subdivisions outside of the city of Phoenix and Las Vegas because of failure to access water. And quotes on the wall from people like Edward Abbey and Mark Reisner, which is, again, another site of sort of dissonance, is that there were no indigenous voices or perspectives included in this sort of eulogy to the collapse of a very sort of settler vision of the West. It sort of applied this white settler optic to drought. That again, like I think put into even sharper relief the type of, critical work the museum was doing, which was sort of insisting on a deeper history, insisting on this sort of extent to which, despite all of this, despite the sort of experiences of water theft and dispossession and drought, that the region's indigenous peoples persist and in fact have won some major water rights victories in the last 20 years or so. And that's sort of, that juxtaposition to me was just fascinating. So I found it a really rich site to sort of consider, consider the sort of ways in which we talk about water and drought in the West.
Yeah, definitely. So, we'd be on like a 2.5-hour episode here if we went in that much detail about all of your case studies. But I did want to give you a chance to just, say a couple words about each of the other three case studies, kind of why you picked them and what your main takeaway that you have from each of the other key case studies is.
Yeah, sure. So, what I really wanted to do in this book was, think about water and water justice from a range of perspectives, a range of geographies to sort of emphasize the heterogeneity of just transitions and how we might think of just transitions in different ways, And so in the first chapter, my sort of takeaway is these sort of counter narratives about drought can really help us understand the importance of and sort of support this broader engagement with indigenous communities, this broader participation of indigenous communities in determining the future of water in the West. My second chapter, I really look at the Flint water crisis as a symptom of racial capitalism, sort of following the work of Laura Pulido. And in doing so, I analyze a play by Jose Casas. He's a playwright at the University of Michigan. It's called Flint. And what's unique about his play, because there are multiple plays called Flint or productions called Flint or documentaries that sort of look at the water crisis, what makes his really unique and interesting is that it's an ethnodrama. So it draws on testimony and interviews from 100 residents of Flint. He sort of hit the ground and sort of pounded on doors and met with people in Flint, and then had students at the University of Michigan perform the transcripts of those interviews, right? And so what it really calls attention to is the ways what the play calls attention to is the ways in which the city was racialized as Black, and sort of the ways in which it was a sort of victim as a city of this sort of disinvestment and abandonment of abandonment by the state. And the play really helps us understand the sort of ways in which systemic racism can produce this sort of politics of abandonment, right? Specifically looking at the extent to which that crisis emerged from efforts to sort of save money by abandoning investment in Black communities, right? And so it really helps us think about ways in which we might imagine a just transition beyond the purview of courtroom litigation and sort of the typical avenues, right? And so beyond that analysis, I look at urban reclamation and art projects like the Flint Public Art Project, really interesting hybrid art project collaborated on by fashion designer Tracy Reese and Mel Chin, an artist, in which they took Nestle water bottles and turn them into fabric and then use that fabric to create a fashion line and use the profits from generating that fabric to pay people in Flint to make these clothing items that sort of suggest a new way or a new way of thinking about community reinvestment and provide a sort of really interesting critique on the Flint water crisis. So that's chapter two, and I'm probably going into too much depth here, but my third chapter, and it's based on an article I published in Environmental Humanities a few years ago, basically looks at sort of Appalachian literary fiction, poetry, and photography, and works to sort of critique the practice of natural resource extraction as a sort of cultural practice, something sort of central to people's identity in places like Appalachia. We see the same thing here in Wyoming, and its sort of takeaway is the sort of conclusion to the chapter looks at a couple of different ways in which landscape architects and artists are imagining a post-extractive Appalachia. And one of those is some really innovative ways of, for example, filtering acid mine drainage from abandoned coal mines and turning it into paint pigment, or sort of using treatment plant or treatment facilities as sort of landscape art that sort of imagines a post-extractive Appalachia without also like condemning its sort of coal past in any way. So it's a really interesting way of sort of adjudicating what a new Appalachia might look like. And the fourth chapter, I really take liberties with the idea of water and hydro narratives. I'm really thinking broadly about sea level rise, and I look at Kim Stanley Robinson's book, New York 2140, and Ben Zietlin's Beasts of the Southern Wild as sort of heuristics for Green New Deal policy proposals that may or may not pay careful attention to the racialized dimensions of climate change adaptation, specifically this concept of racial coastal formation, or sort of like efforts to sort of build up climate resiliency in coastal communities that often privileges or protects white and wealthy communities over Black and brown communities, for example. So a lot of that chapter is predicated around the sort of framework of the racial capitalocene. So that's kind of those are the four main chapters of the book. And then I kind of end with this coda in the book, looking at thinking about just transition as a theory of social change, and really kind of covering the work that I've been doing here on the ground in Wyoming. So that's the overview. And I know I can't go into more depth, but
all right. I think that's good. Yeah. That'll get listeners interested. They can pick up the book for more. Then I also wanted to ask about the cover image for the book, because it's a really striking image here. So if I can try to describe it for folks listening by audio, that is kind of a hybrid of like a view of of the Earth from one of the poles, where you've got this like ice cap in the middle surrounded by water, but then it's also an eyeball with a big black pupil in the middle. So can you tell us about what this piece is and why you chose it for the cover of the book?
It's a great question. So that is a piece of art by an artist named John Sabraw, and he's a professor of art at Ohio University. And he painted this using acid. So basically, the materials filtered out from acid mine drainage, contaminated creek water. And he filtered those iron oxides into different paint pigments, and then turned that iron oxide material into paint. And then he painted this. And he has a whole series, and he calls it toxic art, and it's been displayed around the country in various art galleries. So what you're looking at there, even though it looks like a polar ice cap or an eyeball, is actually the result of basically doing environmental reclamation and then turning it into art. John was really instrumental in helping me write my third chapter. He allowed me to interview him multiple times and really gave me sort of a really interesting glimpse into his artistic practice. And, you know, at the time when I was interviewing him, he was scaling up production. He'd actually created this whole facility along the side of this creek with these murals around the fence that protected the facility that were sort of thinking about what a post-extractive Appalachia might look like. And so he was very happy to agree to put this photograph on the cover. And I was thrilled that he was, agreed to that, because I do agree it's a really striking cover. And just want to give a shout out to the University of Nebraska Press design team for the cover, because I couldn't be happier. So
yeah, it's a really nice looking book, in addition to having good content in it. Okay, so we're moving towards the end of our time here, so I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing this.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, the first person I absolutely have to thank is my wife, Jessica, who supported me through graduate school and, tolerated me sitting long nights working on this, given that we have two small kids. I couldn't have possibly done this project without her, so absolutely have to thank her. Joni Adamson and Claudia Sadowski-Smith, my PhD advisors, were really helpful in not just getting the dissertation to completion, but helping me think about conceiving of this project beyond the dissertation. The Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Wyoming, bringing me on as a scholar in residence, a fancy word for a postdoc, to support the completion of this book. Scott Henkel and the Wyoming Institute for Humanities Research provided funding and workshop opportunities for this project. So I definitely have to say thankful to him and the Institute. And, more broadly than that, gosh, I could go on and on forever. But those are some of the, sort of the primary champions of this book. So I'm just really grateful for the support.
All right. And that brings us to our traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next?
It's a great question. So I've really been doing a lot more work on the climate change and colonialism nexus here at the University of Wyoming. And I am putting together currently a book proposal in tandem with my literary agent for a book for a broad audience, a trade book on the sort of a brief history of climate change and colonialism, with the goal of sort of tying the sort of climate colonialism nexus into understanding climate geopolitics right now. So I'm really excited about that project. And then beyond that, what else am I working on? My goodness. I'm part of a team that just won a three-year, $800,000 Department of Energy grant to study the environmental justice dimensions of nuclear energy siting in Wyoming. And so there's a lot of sort of just transition thinking around that project as well. So those are just a few of the things I'm working on. So I'm really excited about the future and didn't expect to be working on another book so soon, but really excited to be doing it.
So, all right. Well, yeah. I will definitely keep an eye out for that one and maybe have you come back on to talk about it once that's out.
That'd be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me. It was a lot of fun.
This has been a conversation with Matthew S. Henry, author of Hydro Narratives, Water, Environmental Justice, and a Just Transition, published last year by University of Nebraska Press.